that fixes the back problems. And the back problems, in my mind, to your question, have been on the rise. All the other problems are still there, but we're seeing young athletes with low back pain more than ever before. And I think it's because we're just weight training them, but we're not strength training them.
Hello and welcome to today's episode of the Basketball Strong Podcast. I'm Tim DeFrancesco, former LA Lakers strength and conditioning coach and doctor of physical therapy, and I'm here with my co-host, Emmy-nominated writer and author, Phil White. This podcast is not just for basketball junkies. It's for anyone who loves to hear the human stories behind great people while learning the science behind preparing your body for the court and high performance. Today's guest is Gray Cook. Gray is a renowned physical therapist, certified strength and conditioning coach, and kettlebell instructor. He's the founder of Functional Movement Systems and co-creator of the Functional Movement Screen. He's also the author of several books that I consider to be required reading for anyone in the strength and conditioning, fitness, or rehab world. If you are in those professions and you haven't read his books, get to Amazon and order them now. The first one is Athletic Body and Balance, and the second is Movement. Having Gray on hit home with me because when I was at the buffet of learning in the early stages of my professional career, Gray was one of the legends in the field who I soaked up as much insight from as I possibly could. Whether it be attending his courses or reading his books, I couldn't get enough. He has a way of understanding and teaching the nuances of human movement and performance that very few in the industry come close to. This episode is part one of a two-part series with Gray. I'll release part two with Gray next week. On this episode, Gray discusses what he focuses on when everyone else is worried about speed and agility, the difference between weight training and strength training, the key exercises that he thinks all taller athletes, especially basketball players, should be doing, why young basketball players are experiencing back pain like never before, and how to fix it, and much more. Let's get into the conversation. Gray, talk to us a little bit about the difference between maybe managing the insult or the injury in front of you that a person is suffering from, or when they go to get physical therapy or they are work doing some rehab, versus an approach that is going to take that and impact that person once they go back out onto the field and really help to build that durability for them that they need and want.
No, that's a great question. We're realizing now that you know, if you're in an athletic environment, you're going to have an accident, you're going to have an injury, and you're going to face some degree of rehabilitation, whether that's you doing it to yourself or you having to meet a professional. Here's the problem. Every injury checks a box on potentially adding a risk factor to your long-term projection. So every time we get injured, we may think because the pain is gone, all of our normal, and what I'm going to say, functional behaviors have returned. Your balance, your reaction time, the mobility you can use as opposed to just the kind you can get to if you're really warmed up and stretching, all these things. And a long time ago when we started this journey saying what's functional and what's not functional, let me just make that ridiculously clear. A functional exercise is transferable to things that aren't like itself. So I think we could all see that one of the most fundamental activities I've done with young basketball players is jump rope, right? And then while we're pursuing ankle mobility, because that's the kiss of death in high school athletics, it is the number one injury that's going to happen. The ACL, the low back pain, the fractures, these are more disabling and time consuming, but it's that first rolled ankle that could set up a dorsiflexion restriction, a little bit of foot weakness, maybe an asymmetry in what leg that now you mostly have to jump off of. And so that first injury very often makes us feel better if we follow the right rules, but we still haven't gone through a series of filters that is seeing how low is our risk. And what we've learned in doing movement screens at combines, military, PE class, is most people who have a previous injury aren't completely back. There is still, I can still tell you had a wreck by the way you move, not by what you're complaining about. And so we've all got to be really, really, you know, clear is if you know you've got flexibility problems, then don't wait till you're injured to confront them, because they're going to actually take rehab time away from you. You're going to be working on the flexibility issue and the injury now. Or if you've got a core stability issue. When we used to have young athletes with ACL, other physical therapy clinics would just rehab the knee and send them on their way. I'm like, dude, you're not even full weight bearing right now. But on the other side of planks and crunches, right? We're hammering T-spine mobility. We're handling core. We're doing everything we can. And then, yeah, we're doing what we're supposed to do for your knee as well, realizing that you're just becoming deconditioned. Now, that's a proactive measure, and that's going upstream on problems. But I honestly think the consumers, the athletes, the parents, the coaches need to be demanding a little bit more of a movement vaccination, not just a movement Band-Aid. So that's what I want everybody to hear. You know, you're going to have an injury, and if you're not pushing the envelope, if you're not, you know, competing at the level you're supposed to and training as hard, you're going to have some accidents and injuries. We'd like to prevent all the preventable ones and then let you learn from the ones that are inevitable. That's the best we can do. Either way, most people go into their next harsher environment knowing the threats of the environment but not knowing their vulnerabilities.
That's such a good point. And you bring up the ankle sprains, something that hampers basketball players just so chronically. And once one starts, as you said, it can really trigger this cascade, not only to the ankle, but the other ankle. For instance, you have a circumstance where you can, and it just sort of proves this idea that I'd love for you to talk about the fact that you have this global, the site of the injury, but you have this global issue.
Exactly. And you know, my partner in crime, Greg Rose, who's over in the Titleist world with golf and everything like that, but one of our partners at Functional Movement Systems on the clinical end, you know, the site of your pain may or may not be the source of your problem. Yeah. And I think we need to continue saying that irregardless, that after a part has been temporarily disabled or offline, just knowing that part doesn't hurt anymore doesn't mean it's reintegrated back into the system. So you're absolutely right. It can cause a compensation. We notice after an ankle injury, most athletes, if you go back and review the way they move in practice, they just don't get as low. They think they're as low, and their head might be at the same level, but now they've rounded their back and not used their hips correctly. And anything that takes you out of that best reaction athletic position is going to compromise your reaction time. Stuff's going to happen, and it's going to be continually frustrating when easily it was preventable. But what I find is most therapists who really do a good job on intake don't really use something like the movement screen on exit. It's to check your own work, and it's a different ruler than they came in on, because when they came in on, they were hurt. So they need to be held to a higher movement standard. Same thing. I, as a strength coach, I've never taken anybody's word for it. I still do a screen on the other side of bringing them in and figuring out, all right, what's their worst movement pattern and what's their worst physical capacity? This kid has a tight posterior chain, and they can't squat. Those right. Two things run hand in hand. I can figure out something that's going to, you know, work on that pattern while still working on that problem. So.
Love that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Great. To rewind a little bit, you talked a little bit about just the simple benefit of a young basketball player jumping rope. Are there any other particular exercises and or movement patterns that you would introduce to either, you know, a 14, 15-year-old basketball player, that their parent, their coach, anyone else they're working with, that might provide quite a bit of bang for the buck and kind of have some of those, what Pavel calls what the hell benefits, those sneaky benefits that you might not expect on more of that global patterning scale that you're talking about?
Yeah, I like to pick a few self-limiting moves that make an athlete either prove to me they've got it or ask me, what should I do for this? One of the ones I've done with a lot of NBA players who've come through, you know, my clinic in the off season. I used to have a great relationship down at Duke University, so it was really easy to get a pro player into Raleigh-Durham. But one of my favorite drills, and I've used it from youth basketball all the way up to the NBA, is you stand about 12 foot away from a wall with your back to the wall. You then take the ball and do a two-handed bounce pass behind you to the wall, creating an arc that brings the ball right back in front of you. And then you do the same thing to the other side. Now, I don't have to tell you guys, but I'll tell your audience. I'm looking at fundamental weight shifting, T-spine mobility, neck and shoulder mobility, and your proprioception as to how that ball is going to react. So I'm doing a multifactorial movement drill that I think a guy like John Wooden, I wouldn't even have to explain to him what I was doing. He would get it, especially if a kid did not have that crisp rotation, weight shift, and fluid pass behind them to the wall. It's all done so I can watch you naturally rotate. So you might weight shift inappropriately, you're craning your neck to one side, but it's really easy for me to see that. If I see somebody who can't do that easily to both sides, then we go right to the mat on the floor. We do a Bretzel stretch. And Bretzel, I think people can just look that up online. Yeah, it's stretching an entire movement pattern, not just a single muscle group. And they stand back up and they're like, whoa. And I'm like, that's why we stretch. If you can't do a move better after you stretch, I question the stretch. You know, I question the prep, the warm-up that we're asking you to do. So I'm going to show you that face value. So jump rope, the behind-the-back wall pass, and we do a lot of work with med ball. And what I do there is I turn you sideways to the wall and do some half-kneeling. And I make you do a bounce pass to your closed side. Now, what I mean by that is if you're kneeling with your left knee down and your right side to the wall, your right knee's up, your left knee's down. You're doing a bounce pass across your body and catching that. And that goes right back to some exercises I put in my very first book, Athletic Body and Balance, and some that Tim Ferriss actually referenced in the 4-Hour Body, which are those chops and lifts. Yep. They're three-dimensional patterns that force your lower body to stabilize in an extreme hip position and your upper body to react symmetrically both ways. So believe it or not, if say, are you training upper body or lower body? Well, I'm training lower body stability, upper body mobility. And so those are some of the ones that I really like because of the 3D aspect of basketball. And everybody wants to, you know, I think do more speed, agility, and quickness stuff. I want to come in under that and smoke out any viruses that are going to hurt that ability to get low, appreciate your core, and demonstrate symmetry. When Lee Burton, my partner, and I went on this journey at Functional Movement Systems, we were looking for movement patterns that predicted problems. And we got hold of a bunch of military studies, and believe it or not, most of these studies were done by a Dr. Napik. And a lot of his big data said, you know, it's not really people who are tight or weak that seem to show with more problems. It's people who are asymmetrical. I think the inference that we heard was, well, that's, you know, somebody with one leg longer than the other or overdeveloped left side of their back spine. No, it's not. It's they can't lunge as well on the left as they can the right side. They can't turn as well to the left or right. They can't balance as well. These things actually force you to compensate before you even have a chance to think about compensating because it's running in the background. Your body already knows what it can and can't do. So you ask it to go through a movement pattern. It doesn't take a pure path. It goes around the rocks you left in the road.
And that's beautiful. And isn't that what sport is, where your lower body, your lower half is stabilizing or creating a base of balance and support or reacting to what it has to, but while your upper body is doing this dynamic action or whatever it is, whether we're talking about a wide receiver or we're talking about a power forward?
You're absolutely right. And the signature of the skill-based problem should, if it's functional, it'll be seen in these little exercises, because I'll do single leg deadlifts. Okay. So imagine me on standing on my left foot, sticking my right leg out behind me, bending down and either grabbing a kettlebell or a dumbbell off a stool with my right arm. So it's a cross body pull, or I'm pulling two dumbbells. Now this is the opposite, where I'm doing dynamic upper body, static lower body. Now, what am I doing? Dynamic lower body, static upper body. And just doing two simple things like a chop and lift and a single leg deadlift on each side, I can find out if one of your core quadrants is out. The reason it's out, I don't know yet, but I know to look in this quadrant if I'm going to find any more horsepower in you. It's already a liability. It's an inhibition. And a lot of people see a bad pattern as weakness. Mm. And if you've gotten but if I can change, like, I don't know, you know, there, I got videos and stuff like that where I get somebody who hadn't touched their toes in about 10 or 15 years. And it's a little party trick that I do up on stage. And boom, we blast through the pattern and they're touching their toes. And there are other, there are reasons why some people can and some people can, but I've been doing this for a while, so I know which people to pick. But many of us are falling victim to patterns that we create every day. There's no structural limitation behind it. It's muscle tone behind it. It's the way you choose to, you know, fire your pistons, and we call that poor timing. And so when we go in and see these little fundamental hiccups, the last thing I try to do is build skill on top of that. If you look wobbly in a single leg deadlift and you look a little bit poor coordination chops and lifts, you don't see jump rope today, because to me that's a higher level energy storing ballistic activity, and basketball is totally ballistic. So if we've already got wrinkles in movement that I can see before you even add speed to it, many times the good athlete can use speed to hide the functional problem, not express it. So when we pick a test, we put a squeeze on you, a self-limiting that, you know, if you don't have the requisite mobility and stability, you're going to flunk the test. You can get upset about it or be glad we captured it now. So,
Right. Talk a little bit about, double click on what you talked about earlier there, the idea that functional, your definition of functional, and maybe get into a little bit of what has gone awry with the industry or some people's interpretation of what we all have made the mistake of at times of getting too close to saying, let me mimic the sport to make it functional, and where there's error in that.
Well, I learned a long time ago, both as a strength coach and a physical therapist, that, you know, motor learning really doesn't occur in a transferable way unless it's at the speed of competition. So I remember, you know, 30 years ago, people would take a golf club handle and attach it to a bungee cord and just sort of tow their way through a golf swing.
Right.
These two activities have nothing to do with each other, because the speed, you're thinking just by strengthening one end of a pattern that this golf swing is going to start striping the ball. It's not. So when I do chops and lifts or jump rope with basketball players, these moves are happening at or near the speed of competition, like a direction change or a foot strike. But I don't want to look at those if we already got flaws, because guess what's going to happen? We got two kids, both is having difficulty jumping rope. One doesn't know how to use their body, right, in jumping rope, and they just need to stand there and grind it out. The other literally can't. They can't even, you know, that, because they're coming to it 70-30, right? They just don't like putting weight on that one side. The trunk is shifted one way. So both kids are choking at jumping rope. One needs to be jumping rope as a challenge to get better, and the other needs to be pulled completely off the rope. And you wouldn't know that if you've only got one test, you know? So we go for these fundamental mobility and stability signatures, and we have faith that they're transferable. You know, I remember I was doing a lecture, it was at least one kid ago for me, and my youngest is 10. So that tells you how long ago it was. I count in those times. And I think it was a NBA type meeting, and it was in the early days of talking about movement screening. And obviously that very first signature move you see in the front of a movement screen is an overhead deep squat. And I think we all realize that you will never see this movement pattern on the basketball court. So the argument is, my players don't have to do this. Why have they got to cover that move? And it's not because that move is exactly transferable to basketball skill.
Right.
I'm scared if you can't do that move, right? And I was with, remember, you guys seen the thing on Netflix, The Last Dance?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. I got to tell my oldest daughter, I'm like, have you seen that yet? And she goes, yeah. I'm like, I was there. I mean, that's not because of me, but I got to go to the Chicago Bulls when Al Vermeil was still the strength coach.
Wow.
And they were all together, and they were instituting the movement screen and stuff like that. And Al just pulled me aside one day, and a guy like that puts his arm around you and takes a walk. You listen, because you
yeah, yeah.
throw rings in three different sports, right?
Exactly.
So Al pulls me aside, and he goes, you know, I like what you're doing with this movement screen. It's coming at it from a different way than we look at it, but I've noticed one thing. When my big guys can't squat anymore, I just tell the coach to get rid of them because they're on their way out anyway, and that's just the signature I get. So what Al was saying in I think a very eloquent strength coach way is, the sign is always there before the symptom, but you got to know what to look for, right? Wow. When my big guys can't deep squat anymore, they're physically breaking down. And even though they might have the grit and the guts to power out another year or two, it's not going to be their best year. So we got to get rid of them.
Right.
And I mean, you know, maybe I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but I saw a lot of eloquence in that, meaning there's a whole pattern here. It's not just lining people up on the table and looking at ankles and appraising a human being. It's saying, all right, here are all your parts. Run the squat circuit, run the lunge circuit, run the leg raise circuit,
right.
run the push-up circuit, right? And if you're not overheating on any of these, and if none of these hurt you, I'm going to pass you to the next phase of testing. If any of these hurt you, we're going backward, and we're going to answer that question for once and for all. We're not just going to, you know, rub eucalyptus oil on it and power on through or put a knee strap on it, because that's not going to end well. So,
Right. Talk a little bit about what you tend to see or what things have to be taken into consideration, though, as you talk about a big guy or just taller athletes in general, and kind of some of the things that a younger, taller athlete or a taller athlete who's competing at a college or pro level right now needs to consider the differences that you see with those athletes.
Okay. First of all, when we're working with the taller athletes, I think I can make a statement that most coaches, parents, and even taller athletes can identify with. You're not finished growing until you're finished growing. So most larger athletes have a longer growth span than athletes who maybe mature early. So I mean, look at all the NBA players who entered college at one height and exited college at another. Some didn't change their height at all. They were physically mature. Some kept on growing a little bit longer. As long as that musculoskeletal system is growing, you haven't seen full athletic potential yet because there's too much change. And you'll get glimpses of greatness. But until those growth rings are closed down and until they sort of hit that, you know, terminal growth, there's going to be a lot of curveballs. They're going to have aches and pains, and they're going to have inconsistency. And that's a real big issue. And we've seen it a lot. It's easier to see in individual sports, you know, golf and tennis and stuff, because we see kids come up. They're a prodigy. They're doing great.
Yeah.
Then they go through that awkward growth spurt, right? They think about the other sex, they get pimples, and they're angry for no reason all in the same weekend. They were just a kid last Thursday, and now they're pissed off at the world, don't know why, and their knees hurt.
Right, right.
Here's the problem. If you got a kid who's physically dominant in their district or in their region or even in the state, and then they go through their growth spurt, guess what's getting ready to happen? They're getting ready to lose traction. They're getting ready to default all the way back to mere average utility play. They're going to lose some of that greatness, and they're going to have to regain it at a different height, at a different weight, at a different wingspan. And that's hard on them. So we need to realize the only pass I'm ever going to give you to have a crappy movement screen is during a growth spurt, and even then, work on what we find. It's the best way to not let this growth spurt disadvantage you in any way. So taller athletes have more biomechanical lever angles against them with all the assets they have with wingspan and reach and height. They're just as disadvantaged on reaction time, center of gravity, base of support, right? So you could make an argument your larger athletes probably need less asymmetry. If you're going to say it's okay to have a little asymmetry, don't have it in the big guys. Just always keep them working against it. And we've learned that with pitchers in baseball. They're getting bigger, taller, and lankier, but they do everything in one direction. And you better believe that a lot of our conditioning goes exactly in the other direction, not to make up anything, just to keep them balanced out. So your larger athletes are going to have a ballistic growth spurt. They're going to change 6 inches over a season, and they're going to finish growing later than everybody else. So I'm not saying give them a free pass, but bigger, taller athletes need to hammer posture more. And what exercises give us the best posture on the planet? Our carries, not our deadlifts, not our pull-ups, not our push-ups, carries. Good old Dan John, Farmer carries, ESPN, fat guy carrying the beer for kegs around. But we don't do it that way for basketball athletes. We do a light carry, but we do it in 6 different positions. And I think there's some stuff of me talking about this on the internet where we just take a kettlebell or a sandbag or just some type of weight, and we do an overhead walk, we do a front rack walk, and we do a suitcase walk. And then we switch side and go overhead, front rack, and suitcase. So not only are we exploring each column, we do it at 3 different levels of gravity challenge. And the weight can be very minuscule because we're doing a 10-minute walk. And I think the one thing we forget about these growing kids is we want them to have cardiovascular endurance in their prime movers, like their quads and their glutes and their lats. Well, they got to have postural endurance in their stabilizers, which is your TA, your feet, your spine stabilizers. And so one of the things we realized is unbelievably strong individuals with very poor stability is a lot of what comes out of athletics because we train patterns more than we train postures. So what we started recognizing is our big people are always compromising their posture, and they can get away with it because they do have bigger angles. But a lot of times they're going to suffer deceleration injuries, and they're going to have a lot of spinal problems just because of that extra real estate that they got to control. So my big guys, they got to show me they're coordinated enough to jump rope, and they got to have probably more postural endurance than my smaller guys because gravity's been against them for years. So that's
right. Yeah, that's huge. Gravity and the lever length, as you said, is just they're fighting upstream. And like you pointed out so perfectly is, I mean, we drafted Brandon Ingram when I was with the Lakers. Brandon could put on a SportsCenter highlight like nobody else, but there's pictures of me and video of me putting him through functional movement screen, and he's struggling significantly on that. And that's where I always used to talk about, it's like these guys are masters at compensating, and their body will find a way. They can still put on that SportsCenter highlight when the check engine light probably should be coming on, but it's hard to see sometimes because you're so fixated on what they're doing in that practice or in that game.
That's exactly right, and I've been there when a really good athlete is frustrated by something as simple as a screen. And I'm like, all we found was your weakest link. Aren't you glad it's not in three-point shooting, dribbling?
Right.
I mean, everybody's got a weak link to work on. Yours is all the way down here at the bricks and mortar of movement. But incremental changes here make you feel stronger. And the reason they make you feel stronger is not because you're stronger, meaning you have more force or power production. Your timing is better and your collaborative effort is better. That means that whole functional movement, your core, your ankles, your feet, your posture, your head on a swivel, your hands are free and you know, you're moving now. And that's really the essence of that. If I don't see any wrinkles in your movement screen, then everything else we're dealing with is just a physical capacity, maybe deficit, or a skill problem. And that's an easy place to be because we all got tricks to squeeze better skill out of people or take them right to the weight room and build a better power base or build that better first gear on a deadlift or you know, add some agility stuff to their polish. I mean, that's the easy stuff.
No, I love that. Gray, just having been in those MBA facilities and having worked at the college level and everyone down to, you know, high school and junior high basketball players, are there any other compensations or common issues that you see among this basketball population at all levels?
You know, I have been seeing an increase in like back pain issues with developing athletes. Mm. And I think it's because, and this is all on us all. I think we try to build them too much in the weight room and not enough on the court. The first book that I ever wrote was actually in the line of tennis conditioning. Because of a Reebok contract, I got a chance to work with the Williams sisters when they were a little bit older than the King Richard movie. And I did a lot of stuff on court with bungee cords to like cause acceleration or deceleration reaction time stuff. And I love to keep people conditioning in the environment they're supposed to be in. And I think it was probably a billion years ago, I was studying some of John Wooden's stuff. And I mean, this guy, UCLA, didn't have a strength coach. He was a strength coach. That means the practice that I design has to create a physical load and maintain skill in the presence of fatigue, because that's what a game is. So John Wooden would design skill drills that were compressed environments, and then you would sprint from skill drill to skill drill, sort of balancing out your assets as you go. When we get in the weight room, we shouldn't be doing just this general development program. We got to hinge, we got to push, we got to pull. I mean, that's all good in the off season, just developing general readiness. But to me, the weight room is like that study hall where you work on the one subject that you're weakest in. So I've justified why a lot of my NFL players didn't really need to do a lot of lifting in season, because they were dedicating so much time to just owning that flexibility that they were losing. So we could create a physical load so they're not going to get out of shape or fat, but they didn't need to gain any strength. They were already, you know, at the top of their game strength-wise. They were at the bottom of their game mobility-wise. So I think too often we create problems in the weight room that we shouldn't have to do. One in basketball I've seen is making big, tall, lanky people back squat. It ain't right. Going to look pretty, and it's not going to be good for them. They're way better off doing deadlifts. I remember I've had quite a few NFL quarterbacks well over 6'4", and we did a lot more farmer's carries and deadlifts than we did back squats. It's just they're not gonna bring much honor to the exercise, and the exercise is something they're going to end up surviving, but it's not going to really stimulate better growth and mechanics. And my tall guys, I don't let them lift deadlift on a trap bar either. I would rather them go up to a bar that's up off the floor a small amount and short their deadlift a little bit and have that classic form dragging it up their shins than allow them to sort of squat their deadlift in the trap bar. I know it's easier, but I have no problem putting less weight on the bar. I want you to own that hip hinge, because under the basket, you're not jumping off your toes. You're jumping off your hips. So that's that coiled spring phenomenon that we're trying to get. That fixes the back problems, and the back problems, in my mind, to your question, have been on the rise. All the other problems are still there, but we're seeing young athletes with low back pain more than ever before, and I think it's because we're just weight training them, but we're not strength training them. You know, and with strength training you is where I find your greatest weakness, and targeting my resources and my resourcefulness at your problem. And weight training is just getting a general introduction to resistance. And a lot of people, you know, can't tell you much more about the program than this is what I have my big guys do, and this is what I have my little guys do.
Right.
And I think that, but you know what, I can't throw stones. That came from, Stanley McChrystal, one of our last generals in Afghanistan, just wrote a book called Risk. And he basically said risk is threat plus vulnerability. Right. Well, vulnerability is what we bring to the game, and the threat is what are the most prevalent injuries in basketball right now. So we know basketball is a threatening environment. Baseball is a threatening environment for the upper body. You know, football is a threatening environment. So we know the threats, and a lot of people just try to train to the threats, But your individual vulnerabilities will take you out if they're excessive as well. You know, so doing screens like you guys have done allows you to see, okay, what's acceptable here? Because what we do is we reverse engineer the thing. There is no perfect movement screen. It's at what point do we start seeing more problems? And have we ever had anybody with a screen this low not be troubled with injury and also perform at their best? And so I argue it from the bottom. I'm like, how tight can a guy be and still be successful? How weak can a guy be and still be successful? How poor can a person's endurance be and still be successful? And what you find is by doing all these tests and then following the season, you'll find out who your durable performers are. And I hate to say it, but in each region, different numbers will be acceptable. And you start looking at your pack of durable performers and you'll find that they don't post bad numbers anywhere. And they rarely post multiple superlatives anywhere. It's natural selection at its finest, because these people are masters at non-failure, and they have enough non-failures at every rung of basketball development to where they just ultimately succeed more often than not. But too many parents and athletes go for the quick success strategy, and they start training power before they got a base, right? Because they see the pros training power.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, that was a much longer path. You can't hack some of these things, right? It's the Karate Kid all over again.
Right. And that's where I often have parents, coaches, or athletes saying, whether it's the plyometrics or it's the crazy box jumps or it's the band resisted jumps or that the stuff that they see every athlete and that they see on Instagram, their quick excerpt of their workout doing agility ladders in their workout. So they should be doing that and that kind of thing. And there's any one of those things in its own right. If you get there the right way and it is belongs to that person appropriately and responsibly, then that's all well and good. But to your point, if you don't have this foundation, we go way back to the other part of the conversation where if they can't do a med ball chop, and throw then in a half kneel position, then we've just sort of fast forwarded too much of the process and we're just going to be adding these things on top of this base that doesn't exist.
No, you're absolutely right. And just take that half kneeling position. I know a lot of musculoskeletal people that look at that half kneel and say, well, I know why he's doing that. That's a tight hip flexor. Right?
Right.
It's a slippery slope, because let me tell you this. Just stretching that hip flexor won't make them really strike that med ball in that position.
Right.
You ever heard the old saying that soldiers used to say, we get stronger as we go? We're not strong enough now, but we'll be strong enough when we get there. That's periodization, right? And yeah. So a lot of times, if the athlete is struggling in a movement pattern, like their right half kneeling med ball chop pass is great, but they go left and they just look like a deer on ice, man. They're
right.
Wobbly. They can't generate any force or whatever. Man, I just let them sit there and sweat it out, because that hip flexor is going to get a little longer and that glute's going to get a little stronger and that posture is going to get a little more upright and that axis of rotation is going to come back. But if I keep pulling them out of that competitive against myself environment and keep saying, well, we got to stretch it. It's all got to work together right here anyway. So let them struggle for a while and say, listen, I'll know you're doing your stretches on your own time when you can come back and do this better. That's homework. I need to see this look better next time you're here. Well, what have I got to do for that? Well, you can go practice this, or you can do some of the, you know, position work. Chops and lifts with a band will help you get your base. Stretching the hip flexor will help you find your range of motion. But I give them a task and say, it's important that you do this on both sides. And when they can't, I let them ask me the supplemental work. Mm. And if they ask for it, they're going to do it. And if I assign it, probably not.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about your take or where you weigh in, Gray, on long levered athletes, basketball athletes, volleyball athletes, where applying the modality of Olympic lifts and kind of what the risk reward there is and what your experience has been there.
Well, I love the Olympic lifts, and I think I was a year out of maybe PT school, maybe 2 years out when I got my USAW level one coaches. And, yep. and my instructor for that was Mike Gattone, who later was at the Bulls when I went back wow. around.
wow.
As a strength coach, so full circle, he's teaching me Olympic lifting and I'm teaching him the movement screen. But if you can't right. see fundamental Olympic lifting within the movement screen, you're missing it. Cause the thing that hit me like a ton of bricks is the Europeans would train with a broom handle so they could rock bottom a squat. Americans don't have that kind of time. They said, load me up now. Let's see what I can do, yeah. you know? And so bringing, you know, honor to that movement is important. But the long lever athlete, to me, has a different path that they got to cover.
Yeah.
And I like to make sure that they've got plenty of mobility, because most of the time a long levered athlete gets stiff out of protection, not lack of work. It's protection. It's like
they're yeah. riding
around with a parking brake on, and they have to tense up because they don't have good brakes. So they ride around right. in a low gear with the parking brake on. And so here's where everybody sort of messes up. I too see that these athletes are inherently unstable, and their quick solution to this instability, this inconsistency, is just stiffen up. So you see a lot of these people, even with no weight, their heels flat, they're not going below parallel. And I don't call them tight. They're sort of sprung up that way. That's a body in protective mode. And we've even got a name for it over on the physical therapy side. It's called a high threshold strategy. Yeah. And that's when you completely lose contact with your TA and you try to plank your way through every extreme position. And these people, they blow up hard when they blow up. They blow their ACL. They have back injuries that are recurrent. They have real, real multi-level movement problems. And it's all because we tolerate that signature of tightness. And those of us who put these people on flexibility programs, they don't stick. They don't hold, because it's like writing the best document in the world.
That's right.
And not hitting save on the document, right? So we realize it's almost good if you earn your mobility and stability hand in hand. Now, on the movement screen, you flunked a mobility test. But yeah. I'm not naive enough to think that there's an underlying reason you're tight. And it's either the fact that anatomically – you've got an injury that's keeping you from having the freedom where you should, or your body doesn't trust any more range of motion than it's given you. And I would like to think with a growing, developing athlete, you're going to see like two-thirds, one-third. Two-thirds of the kids are just training in the wrong direction, and they have an unnecessary burden of muscle tone that's keeping them out of these movement patterns where they could actually develop better skill and reaction time. Those are the two things we got to have on the basketball court. I need you to have these fundamental skills, and I need your reaction time to be a little bit better than your opponent, and it's going to work out pretty good.
right. So it's really, I mean, not to oversimplify, but there is this circumstance in this instance that you see with the taller athlete where we're talking about a strengthen to lengthen type approach that's necessary.
Exactly. They're not going to let go of that high threshold strategy. And what that is if I pulled up next to you and your car is just sitting there running smooth, and my car sounds like, even though I'm sitting in neutral, it sounds like I got my foot on the gas. They're idling high, right? They're going to use more fuel. They're going to be inefficient. They can't idle down anymore because they'll cut completely off. So they've got to keep their foot on the gas all the time. And that's a burden. And when you see a kid showing up to camp and they're having to have their foot on the gas all the time just to hold their limbs together and keep their spine organized, they're either going to be mentally fried or physically fried or both. And it's going to look like they're your biggest problems because they're just tired all the time.
Right.
And, you know, and a lot of these kids, I mean, I see these kids all the time that tell me, you know, for the last 6 months, I'm taking Tylenol PM every night just so I can sleep. That's an analgesic and an antihistamine. And this is a kid that is just really trying to get better at something. And I'm telling you, if something you're trying to get better at also puts you in pain, not wow. many of us are going to make it there. It's just, you know, shutting your fingers in the door as lightly as you can. Doesn't sound good, does it? You know, but I see a lot of kids that literally they're in pain every day, and they learn how to avoid certain movement patterns, which looks like tightness, but you get on the other side of that tightness, they got pain.
Right.
They, you know, and so when we start pushing them into stretching and exercise, they're actually going right up against that very uncomfortable place, but they're scared to say anything. Mm. And back to the movement screen, that's why I give them a chance early on in the movement screen to tell me that this thing's not right.
Right.
It looks so irrelevant to basketball, they'll actually tell me that, yeah, back of my knee gets me when I deep squat. Oh, good. Glad we found it out now instead of halfway through the season.
Yeah.
And it's no big deal, you know? And I don't even tell people how they do on a movement screen. I'm like, based on the data we just collected, here's where we need to start working with you.
Oh, I like that.
They don't need the whole report card. Yeah, they just need to know the class that we're going to focus on right now. And I find so many trainers and strength coaches feel they have to give this unbelievable blueprint explanation of everything we just did. The consumer's not interested. Your peers are. They want to hear you do a whole dissertation.
right.
What exercises do I need? And I always tell the kid, I'm like, here's the exercises you need to do, and you don't need to tell me if you're doing them or not. I'll know. And they just open their eyes nice and wide. I'm like, yeah, I'm that good at what I do, right?
Well, I just thought, you know, what you said, not only is the athlete or the end user not interested in what your big sort of summary is, it's like, well, what can I do here? But it's also, it could be very tangling of the web when you start putting all this data in front of them of what you just found and how this is off, or in your opinion, this, that, and the other thing. And it can really sort of, certain athletes, certain clients, certain patients, they really, it just creates this whole, it opens up their mind to this area that they never even thought of, like, oh, I'm that messed up, or I'm this, that, and the other thing. And they go down this whole other pathway.
Yeah, no, and a lot of times I think that initially when we first introduced the movement screen, and good God, that was all the way back in the late 90s at the time, I honestly think a lot of strength coaches realized, oh my goodness, this is going to flesh out a lot of problems, but most of the athletes I work with are getting by on confidence and carbs, right?
Right,
if you
right.
take one of those away, they're going to crash.
Yes.
Yeah, I never did this to undermine anyone's confidence, and I really realize we're dealing with delicate issues. I mean, you know, we've done movement screen workshops and movement screening with all six SEAL teams, and you're not going to find a more gritty human being than somebody who's been through that. The irony is when we're working on those guys, they want to hear what we're doing with the football players. When we're working on football players, they want to know what we're doing with those guys. I'm like, same damn stuff. The football player's got to last about 4 years and the SEAL's got to last about 14.
Right.
if things work out right. So one of you's got to be significantly more durable, and one of you has to specialize. That's all that really comes out of this. But no, I talk about it as an opportunity.
Yeah.
And you know, even though I say there's no such thing as a hack, biologically speaking, there isn't. You're supposed to grow and adapt to the environments we stick you in a pretty durable and sustainable way. But having said that, if I help you rock bottom a deep squat and convert that into a better standing long jump, and then convert that into a vertical leap, and then convert that into some crisp jump rope, yeah, a lot just happened there, but none of it would have happened if we hadn't cleared that deep squat first, because then your pelvis wouldn't have been in the right place to accept all the piston work we're getting ready to do. And so people who can't deep squat, you know, we said, well, how do we fix this anterior pelvis quad dominant posture? Well, by the time you got them deep squatting, they will have that pelvis back on a swivel and they won't be so sprung up in the front and in the low back. And that's it. So most people try to change a standing posture in the posture where they see the problem. The other end of standing is squatting, and they got way more problems in squatting than they do in standing. So as they pick up the depth in squatting, they will reduce their valgus collapse. They'll open up that groin. They'll get their glutes in a nice, nice biomechanical slot. They'll definitely not have a dorsiflexion problem anymore, and their feet are going to get stronger. And so people are saying, I'm going almost in the opposite direction of deep squatting to fix your upright posture, because you can't squat right. deep with a fixed pelvis. That pelvis has to go through those two little winks to get you all the way down. And even though we don't lift from that low, that goes right back into the Olympic lifting. We always want to see more range of motion than you're using. So when you can rock bottom a broom handle over your head, I know you're not going to go that deep with a snatch or a clean and jerk. I already know that. You're going to have that little bit of a resistance, that hard bottom with muscle tone. Whereas if you show me a little bit deeper with your own mobility, I just know that you're going to be clean in that motion. Yeah. And I didn't finish answering the question about Olympic lifting. The Olympic lift that I start with doesn't look like an Olympic lift at all. I'll take my young athletes over to a rack of dumbbells or kettlebells. I'll have everybody put a single dumbbell up on their shoulder like they're just going to do a overhead press. And I find a weight that they can't press with locked knees all with their arm. And then I say, I'm going to let you cheat. I'm going to let you use your legs to jump that thing up over your head. But then I want you to lock everything out and lower it as slow as you can. So what I'm doing is a push press with an eccentric lower. Cool thing here is they're getting a huge amount of stability on the negative, and they're learning how to coordinate their legs and upper body in the positive. So there's never a reason for me for a basketball player to do overhead presses. When you could do push presses, because I'm welding your legs and hands together in these movements. And then I've already got my symmetry argument built in, because they're not going to be as good on that left press as they were on the right. But I'm like, you're using the same two legs to get it up, right? I didn't take your legs away from you. Your arm should only be doing the last 25% of this on the lockout anyway. But what I'm getting is just all this core and glute activation on that eccentric lower. Remember, this is a weight they can't press concentrically. So I'm already overloading the shoulder complex, but that shoulder looks a lot stronger when they get their posture under it. So I just do a push press. If the kids who can already deep squat, they do a front squat, come to standing, push press, eccentric lower, front squat, do about five on each side, and let them rest between each side. And before you know it, whether these kids ever make it to Olympic lifting or not, they got what Olympic lifting is supposed to give them, which is that welded together. Nothing works in isolation. You're moving your arm, your leg is contributing. You're moving your leg, your arm is contributing. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and that's interesting too, because such a good point that Phil and I had a great discussion on Olympic lifts with taller, longer levered basketball type athletes. And just what my point was, it's a discussion about risk reward, and it's a discussion about what's realistic for athletes that often come in with a low training age and these physics that don't always match up with that action. And so to your point, you've taken the objective, or one of the objectives of why somebody would apply the modality of Olympic lift, of being able to get that to all work in symphony. And, or you could also say one of the objectives for many people is, oh, well, we got to get power, power, power for these athletes because it's a power game. But to your other point, you then start to combine and put together the story you're telling a little bit, because you talked earlier about the fact that, well, you're a little bit more focused and want to double down on this hinging deadlifting action, because how are they going to go up and power up for at the rim and gather themselves to go up and block somebody or go up for a power dunk or do those things is through their hips. It's not through their quads, like a squat dominant type movement, a knee dominant type movement is going to give you anyways.
Exactly. And I don't need to, it's almost like a Simon Sinek, start with why.
Yeah.
I don't need to do the Olympic lifts as they're practiced in the Olympics to have power come into a basketball player's life. Because let's take the two that we just talked about. Good fundamental deadlifts and some push presses will get me working both my hinge base and that crisp sort of quick jump that we're getting from the push press. Now, if I really want to add a little bit of velocity to the hips, I don't give them a straight bar. I give them a kettlebell swing. Because now we can take what we gained in that good old grind deadlift and just give them a package of swings that makes them transfer energy from their hips through their core to their trunk and back down again. So, you know, I think a lot of times we throw the baby out with the bathwater. And so the Simon Sinek method is, why are we doing it?
Yeah.
How are we going to do it? What's it going to look like? So while we're doing it is to weld the body together in a power move. How we're doing it is exactly what you're already sensitive to. I got people lifting weights that don't look like weightlifters. That means we've got to mitigate risk and maximize reward. Well, that means we're going to take what the Olympic lifts give us nutritionally and back up and look at some of those macronutrients without ever practicing something with a straight bar that these people are not built for anyway. You know, some will, but for the most part, it's unnecessary to learn a snatch or clean and jerk to play better basketball.
Right.
But I could easily justify a swing and a deadlift for somebody who doesn't know how to use their hips. So.
Right. Right. Exactly. And when I really kind of start to dissect a little bit of swing action on the kettlebell swing and the amount of range, it's a short, quick range. You're not having this big sweeping kettlebell is going to drape along the grass on the ground type of work where you're getting real low with it or anything like that. And I think back to what, you know, I was taught, what a lot of athletes are taught and how you play defense, like Wojo used to for Duke, and you get way feet super wide and you get super low enough to slap the floor. And that there may be some errors in that in terms of where you're most able to produce power from. It's quick, short, just power up, power down, power up, but it's not power way down and gather yourself and get your butt to the ground and kind of come back up. It takes too long to do that.
It does. And with these longer lever arms, it's better to express power in a slot of power and mobility in an environment that'll accept mobility. So if my big guys can deadlift, swing a kettlebell, and show me a deep squat, I'm not worried if they can, you know, clean or not, because they've retained the mobility that they might need if they fall or hit the ground and have to roll.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
They've retained that body soft ability to, you know, resist an injury. I don't think they mind me talking about this. I saw one of my athletes with the Colts, Dallas Clark, was a tight end. He went down. Every announcer on the game knew he had blown his ACL. And sure enough, when they did a Lockman's test on the sideline, this guy was just like, knee was sloppy all over the place. Now, he's a legit 21 on the movement screen and unbelievably strong in the legs. 3 days later, that ACL wasn't loose anymore. I mean, Bruce Lee said it. Well, you know, it's better to bend than break.
And, wow.
And so I've seen a lot of people go down when everybody else called it an injury. And had they had more mobility, stability, and symmetry problems, it would have probably ended up with a scar on the knee. But there's something about these athletes that are powerful, quick, and haven't sacrificed mobility to get there. They just come back. They come back quicker from injuries because they didn't have this aggregate effect of four other problems they got to rehab around when they get there. So the best way to survive your next injury is to not have any other unnecessary baggage on you when you get there. And the periodic screens that you used to do sort of proactively before we start a training module or at the end of the season, or if they're going to be on their own for a while, these are the touch points where we re-baseline the athlete. We assign them the work. They're either going to do it or they aren't, you know, but we're very precise and accurate about what they do. And for the most part, I think athletes have responded to it because, you know, when I first entered the NFL arena, linebackers used to all work out the same, and D tackles used to work out the same, and the QBs used to work out the same. And now, yeah, we know what the position demands from you, but we also come at it for, and this is where your weakest link is. And when athletes feel that level of individualization, even though they were all processed through the same poking, prodding, testing, you know, development strategies, each one had a little bit of an individual assignment. And I've seen the good athletes, for the most part, if you say this is your weakest link, we can talk about anything else you want to talk about, but what determines the strength of the chain? And they're like, yeah, I get it now, you know, and they do. They appreciate not so much me pointing out their weakness or their flaw. It's the fact that this is an easy opportunity to fix, because we have the technology to fix movement problems, but we've really got a lot of bias toward the parts of your body as opposed to the patterns of your body. And so we assume if your knee doesn't hurt anymore, that all your knee patterns are there. They're not. And you know, that's really, but I think they appreciate that to some degree, if we don't get too geeked out with our test.
All right, crew, there's part one. Stay tuned for part two with Gray Cook next week. Thank you for joining us today. If you enjoyed today's show, and we hope you did, please give us a good review on Apple Podcasts or whichever platform you listen to podcasts on. And so you never miss a weekly episode, be sure to subscribe and follow. You can find previous episodes on our show website. That's www.basketballstrongpodcast.com. For more basketball performance resources and nagging injury solutions, follow me on Instagram at TDAthletesEdge and follow Phil at PhilWhiteBooks. Until next week's episode, stay basketball strong.